I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this week's very special episode of the Proper Class Podcast, coming at you live from Hoxton Hall, baby. Make some noise, Hoxton!
That's right. We are very pleased to say that we are here as part of Hoxton Hall's class season, encouraging and challenging conversations about what class means in the 21st century.
Yes, so behave yourselves, everyone, please, and keep it classy. I mean, I know half of you is, so I don't know why I'm even asking, I dread to think. We are, of course, your hosts for this evening. I am Laura Checkley.
And I am Hannah Chiswick.
And as usual, we are here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't... Oh my God, we fucking rehearsed that. Who the bloody hell will? It's a catchphrase, it will catch on.
It won't. It's absolutely flogging a dead horse. As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. And on that note, who are we celebrating in this special live podcast, Law?
Me, only joking. No, I'm really thrilled that we've managed to bag this incredibly talented man. He is a comedian, writer and a presenter. In 2017, he was nominated for the prestigious Best Newcomer Award at the Edinburgh Festival. Since then, he has gone on to become one of comedy's biggest hitters, gigging all over the UK to sell out crowds.
In 2019, he was nominated yet again for his sellout show, Good Heart Ute, which made him the first Black Brit to be nominated twice. And in fact, he's still the first Black Brit to have been nominated twice. Only one. Yep. Wow. That show went on to become a series for Radio 4 called Black Label. He's also a regular face on panel shows such as Mock the Week, The Last Leg, 8 out of 10 Cats, Great British Bake Off, Extra Slice, The Apprentice, You're Fired, and Don't Hate the Players, to name but a few. But one of his biggest gigs to date surely has got to be hosting the prestigious Live at the Apollo.
He was then given his own stand-up special for Comedy Central and has also turned his hand to presenting too in Dave's travelogue, British as Folk, and The Dog Ate My Homework for CBBC. I have to concentrate when I say that because I always say too many BBBBCs. And not content with being all over our telly boxes, you can also hear him on the old wireless too. That's the radio for the youth out there. In shows such as News Jack Unplugged, The Now Show and BBC Radio 5 Live.
But surely his biggest achievement to date has got to be being immortalised in a mural in Birmingham, which celebrates the city's rising stars. He's also currently the face of the West Midlands. Yeah, encouraging people to come to Brum for the Commonwealth Games. And he told me just before we started this recording that if you go within a 200-mile radius of Birmingham, you will literally see his face at every single train station.
He is described as a British Richard Pryor and one of the most exciting comedians on the circuit in this country. Please, everyone, go insane. Give it up for the tremendously talented and hilarious Darren Harriott!
What an intro.
Oh, I know, right?
Oh, man, that was like a eulogy. Oh, jeez. That was great.
Oh, how does it fit? We always ask our guests how it feels hearing really nice things said about you, because I know I, being a working class girl myself, I know a lot of people feel like that anyway. When you, people are saying nice things about you, you kind of just go, oh, no, not me.
I was like, wow, I did that?
Yeah, right.
Whoa, what a ride.
It is a strange thing. It's like our version of This Is Your Life. You're too young to remember This Is
no,
Your Life.
No, I remember it, that big red book.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun.
I always wondered
you
what was in it, though.
You are a paedophile. That was literally what happened. 90% of them were Operation Yew Tree guys.
What was in the red book? Was it just photos nothing. Of people they like once knew?
Empty.
Oh, that's really disappointing.
Yeah, they gave it to them.
They'd always act like it was like a surprise as well. Yeah. I was like, you agreed to have your mum here. Oh my God, you're here, mum? What? Yeah. That was an interesting. I think we don't really need that anymore because we've got social media, isn't it?
It's just constant. This is your life.
Yeah.
Doesn't really have the same. This is your Twitter feed. We start every week by asking our guest if they could take us back to a place that reminds them of their working class past. If you were going to take us somewhere, where would you take us? Where are we going?
Reminds me of my working class past. All right. It'd have to be, obviously, in the black country where I'm from. I always think of my school as being, like, it always felt really working class. But maybe it was because everybody I knew was working class.
And really,
it was very middle class. The reason I mention my school is I always remember just, like, free school meals. I was always on the free school meals. And I always thought that the free school meal kids were the coolest. Because we
did too.
We didn't have a lot.
I didn't want a packed lunch.
Ah, packed lunch, come on.
I was so bored of my fucking packed lunch.
Oh.
I so wanted one of those dinners.
Oh, yeah, get lost with your, what's that? Oh, Dairy Lee.
I know.
Your mum's got her shit together. Make sandwiches in the morning. Nah, I didn't like that at all. Yeah, we used to get the tokens, and I just remember we'd all sort of queue up and get our little tokens, and it was like, you know, chip, burger and chips for, I think it was like, £1 back then or whatever. And I just remember, like, the reason I mentioned school is I remember we were, you know, quite poor, you know, sort of growing up. It was a lot of, like, there was a catalogue called Kay's Catalogue.
That was it.
It was like, right, birthday's coming up, Kay's Catalogue, what do you want? And it was always based on...
She loves a catalogue. Don't you still use a catalogue?
Literally, somebody asked me the other day, where did you get your dress? And I said, it's from Very out the Littlewoods catalogue. And they were like... Where did you actually get it? And I was like, from the Littlewoods catalogue.
I didn't think it was still going, I've got to say.
I know very.com. That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's part of the Littlewoods catalogue.
But that's part of the...
I didn't know that.
And I'm the only person, I think, who they still send a physical catalogue to.
That's so mind-blowing to me that the Littlewoods... It's like saying, oh, where'd you get that from? I got it from ASOS as a part of the World Wide Net.
I actually go through the whole thing. Yeah, no, I like it.
Yeah, so I remember my mum would say, you know, what do you want? And it was like, one, you know, it's got to be a new coat. It's got to be this coat that we got to get at school. Because when, you know, me and my friends, we used to sort of value having the right clothing, trying to look cool, even though we couldn't afford it. So, I mean, my mum definitely went into debt. You know, she'd buy us like a £90 coat in 2001. But it was, she'd have to pay like £3 a week.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, the interest on it. And sometimes by the time she'd paid it off, it was already ripped.
You needed another one.
And I just remember everybody I hung about with was at the same kind of level as us in terms of like money and all that sort of stuff. And I get really prideful about it because I just know that we made the best of a bad situation, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
Like I knew we didn't have a lot of money. But I never really felt like I didn't, probably because everybody else was kind of in a similar position as us. But then, you know, there was clear distinctions. Like back when I was a kid, there was a pair of shoes called Rockports that you even... They were called Rockports, right? And they Rockports, and they range from £150 to £260.
The trainers?
School shoes. This is the thing. They were school shoes. So it was classic. You get these, you keep them... All your life. I could not afford Rockports at all. And then certain people who were free school meals would get Rockports, and they'd be their mom was like in debt because they just had to do it to keep them cool,
my mom was like, I can't get into any more. Like, I can't pay £250 for trainers. There's no way I can afford it. And then a shoe came out called the Wallaby.
I was going to say
I loved a Wallaby.
Of course.
I had a suede pair.
The Wallabies came, because, yeah, Wallabies are old. They came back, like, big time, 2002, 2003 for me, and they were £20 from Bacon Shoes.
Bacon Shoes.
And Bacon
the best part was all the kids with Rockports went, no, we need to get Wallabies now. So we were all on the same level.
Are you telling me you made Wallabies cool again? Oh, is that what you're saying?
So cool. I was like, thank you, 20 quid. Just seeing these kids throw away their like £180 Rockports to wear Wallabies sort of leveled the playing field for us for at least 2 years.
It's really interesting you talk about, you know, mums and dads spending too much, way more money than they've actually got to turn you out. Well, I think we were talking about this the other day on another podcast. And I know it was the case with like my family that, you know, we kept our trainers super clean. Everything was ironed within an inch of its life because that's how you perceived someone to have money. They turned themselves out well. And it's just interesting to hear you say that because turning yourself out well is really important in a working class upbringing and environment, isn't it?
Completely. It's some people call it flossing, where it's like, we might not own our house. We, you know, you come into our house, there might not be wallpaper on the walls necessarily. The couch might be a little bit beaten up. Tell you one thing though, the kids, when they're on the street, you don't know that. That was like our house. That was like our house. When we walked out and we looked good, people would go, oh, because you'd get respect.
Yeah,
you'd be treated well. If you didn't look good, you'd be, you know, you'd look down on and, you know, and people would probably treat you a little bit differently.
Yeah,
so you all kind of had to keep this uniform look. But we all knew that as long as we looked good when we left, fine. Doesn't matter about everything else at the house. Because nobody else knows except
us. Yeah.
So that was so important for us, just our externals going to school. And just how we looked.
And so, like, how was school in general? Did you enjoy it? Did you have a good time? Was it a happy experience?
I mean, I don't think I enjoyed it in terms of lessons and classes.
Sure.
Why I'm a comedian. I didn't want to do any of this stuff, man.
Were you funny at school? Did you use that like a lot?
I was very funny at school. So me and my friends, we got into like hard grime music and garage music, right? So then we like formed our own gang and started making music and all that, which doubly added to like wanting to be cool and tough because you can't be in a gang and not look cool, you know?
Yeah,
Come on, what are we? We're not laughing stock. So
in your Wallaby,
my Wallabies, man. And I remember I didn't enjoy any lessons. Except drama. Drama was the only one that I was into.
Wow, there's a load of actors in.
it was like a light bulb going off when I did drama. And I'll never forget this. I should bring this up to my mum. So my mum, you know, she's a good egg, man. Hardest working woman I know. But she knew, she had two boys, me and my brother is 2 years older. And her thing was, don't really care about your grades. Just try. And stay in school and don't be in trouble. Because my mum was one of the, you know, classic, I just don't want them phoning me about your behaviour or anything. Just like, just do what you want, but just don't bring it to me, right? Anyway, I remember parents' evening and there was a drama teacher, his name was Mr. Edmondson. I wish I knew his first name. You know, you don't know teachers' first names.
Never knew. Like,
Mr. Edmondson, right? And we really connected. We did drama, I was loving it. And at this time, I was still like, acting like I was in a gang. About a year before that, I was carrying a knife around. It was that sort of thing. But then I was bloody acting, like legitimately loving it. And I remember parents' evening, and it was the same thing from every teacher, man. Easily distracted, class clown, thinks he's funny, tries to make people laugh. That was me. And then she went to my drama teacher with my mum for parents' evening. And he went, look, I'll be honest with you. I think Darren could have a career in acting. I actually think he's good enough where he could be an actor. And you know how you know your parents' looks? Yeah. So I'm looking at, as he's saying that, I'm looking at my mum. My mum's just doing this, oh. Oh. And she's looking at me like, you this fucking idiot. Like she, and I'm thinking to myself, oh God. And my mum, she was just like, you an actor? She didn't even question me about it. It was just a thing that
just not a thing, is it? It's like not a thing. Your parents are like, what? What is that?
My mum didn't believe I was a comedian until her friends saw me on Mock the Week.
How long had you been a comedian before she sort of finally said...
I've been a comedian 11 years. She was like, I guess it worked out for you, huh?
It's such a mad career, though, isn't it? It really is such a mad career. Acting, any of that. Like, you know, my family are great. They do get it. But it's hard for them to understand. Like, why can't you be at the wedding? Why can't you be at someone's 40th? It's like, I just can't. I've got to work. Like, it's
exactly the same. When I was... Because I started doing comedy when I was 18. And then me... telling my mum, oh, mum, I'm going I'm off to Brighton for this evening from Birmingham, which is Birmingham to Brighton and back the same night. We'd leave at like 3 p.m. We'd come back at like 1 a.m. And mum's like, well, what are you doing? So I'm doing comedy at a gig there because it opens. So how much I pay you? I don't get paid. It's free. You went all the way down there and come back. Well, yeah. And that is... That was literally my career for about 8 years.
Yeah, going everyone, on. Yeah.
And that is comedy. And, you know, for a lot of people, they don't really believe that you would do that for so long. It's like you know, you're actor, comedian, director. Director must be even stranger to try and
people
explain.
Don't understand that at all, do they?
I don't blame them. It's ridiculous. Yeah. That's absolutely ridiculous job. Yeah. I was thinking about it today. I was like, doing it today because it's my job. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, oh, people are looking at me, and because I was actually just thinking, what a ridiculous job.
Just telling people where
telling
to stand.
Telling other people how to pretend. Like, what a fucking ridiculous job. When I said at school, that's what I... Because I knew I wanted to do it, and I said at school I wanted to do it, and the man went, it was my 16th birthday, and we were in a porter cabin in the car park at school, and I had to go in there, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, I want to be a theatre director. And he went, considered hairdresser? I was like, mate, look at my hair. No, I haven't.
You said it, I was going to say.
Hey, Jesus. That was his advice. And I was like, I'll give it some thought. And he went, okay, bye-bye. And that was it.
Right, so you're at school.
Yep, yeah.
Yep. Your drama teacher said, all right, let's consider a career in acting.
Mm-hmm.
Your mum didn't look too pleased. What happened? How did you get to comedy from school?
I didn't do very well in my sort of GCSEs.
Did you do A levels or anything? No.
Well, I did the A levels. I left and then I went to college because I feel like for a lot of people, they feel like you have to go to college.
Yeah. Like, what else are you going to do?
What are you going to do? So I went straight to college and I did a BTEC drama course, and it was all right. Like, I love drama. It was fun. Problem was, wasn't really into anything outside of the actual practical acting stuff.
Yeah, so, the writing bit, yeah.
Oh gosh. I can't remember that. I can't remember the guys' names. Look, I understand that they're legends of acting, but I don't give a shit, mate. Like, can I just do a cap? What is it? Like, I can't remember what the guy's name. I think they were like...
The dude's
like,
called Stanislavski.
Stanislavski! That's the bloody one. And there's another one. That's a little...
Chekhov. Shit.
No, not Chekhov. There's the next one.
Shakespeare's.
Brett, that guy. I remember all of those dudes and being like, not for me. And then we had to do the stretching stuff as well.
Stretching's very important in acting. Breathing. Very important.
Don't forget breathing. Breathing.
2 hours in a bloody cat position. Fuck off.
Lovely.
The one thing that kept me in though was bloody, I tell you this now, EMA. EMA, Educational Maintenance Allowance. It was £30 a week as long as you turned up to every class.
No.
It was it was Blair or Gordon Brown back then, if I remember correctly. It was Labour, so...
I went to drama school during that time because my parents were like, stop auditioning for places, we ain't got any money. And I said, well, I'm going to get a scholarship. I was just determined I'd get a scholarship. And under that government, the Tony Blair government, that Labour government, nearly everyone was on a scholarship in my year, and that's incredible. Now, nothing. This is like really, really depressing.
Well, I use that to its full max.
You got £30 just given to you.
£30 a week, as long as you... So here's the thing, how EMA worked. Educational Maintenance Allowance. Oh, God, it was great. Yeah. Every week, you turn off, obviously, you know, if you're late once, you do not get your EMA. So the problem was... As good as it was, if I was late once, I was like, well, I don't want to do any of these lessons now. My 30 quid's not coming. My 30 quid's not there now. What's the point? And then, not long after that, I got a job. So I was quite lucky because the guy who I was doing my BTEC drama with was a supervisor at a JD Sports in a place called Merry Hill.
And that was your first job?
And he got me a job at JD Sports literally about 10 days after my 17th birthday. So I was quite lucky. £3.16 an hour. and I would do about 9 to 12 hours a week because I would go after college. So I'd finish at, get there at half six, start at half six till like half nine.
Did you get free sneaks when you were
no,
at JD?
No, you used to get 30% off. Okay. Then I got sacked for stealing.
You're stealing trainers.
I didn't. Here's the thing about me, right? I talk a good talk, but I'm a bit of a coward when it comes down to it.
Brilliant.
So I remember I took some trainers. Right, everybody was on the rub. Everybody in there was on the rub, like bad rub. Like it was like that BBC show Hustle. It was like a guy would walk in, buy a pair of trainers, and there'd be a bag already under the table that was full of trainers and whatnot. And he would just give them two bags as he walked out. And it was like, turns out it was my friend's friend. Obviously, I didn't know about this, but there was nine people in there who were all in except me. They told me about it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to do this. So I grabbed a pair of the most expensive trainers in the back, hid them, put them in a place that nobody would know. Anyway, you know when you do something really, really bad or wrong, you're hyper-aware of everything. I remember about 2 minutes after that, I heard a phone in the background, and I'm like, weird. Supervisor walks across, goes there. Anyway, 10 minutes later, I go back. The trainers are gone from where I've hid them. Because I decided I don't want to steal them. I chickened out. I was like, I don't want to steal them. I want to go put the trainers back. I don't want to do this. Gone. 6 weeks later, turns out they have cameras everywhere that they don't tell people.
Sure.
Fucking CCTV. Yeah,
we all got sacked. There was like, all nine of us got sacked.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. But what annoyed me was I didn't take anything.
No. Didn't even get the fucking shoes.
But you did put them under the thing, babe.
Like, I did, but I went to put them back. I was gonna.
They didn't know that, though, did they? I know.
I tried. You really are a screw.
I know.
I know. Big character.
I tried to get them out. But what annoyed me was the guy went, "Yeah, I mean, look, it's you know, everyone's young who works here. We know there's lots of thefts. We don't tell people about cameras for obvious reasons. But you know, if you've took anything, fine. You're fired. Just go." And I was like, no, but I actually didn't take
it. Is there any chance of taking the trainer that I was going to know?
My one friend who was there for about 3 years said he took like $4,500 worth of stuff in total.
Wow.
In total. Wow. And I'm like, what is going
Not
on?
Not even one pair of shoes.
When I used to waitress, I was really skin. And someone told me that when someone orders a coffee, just don't put it in the system. Just handwrite it on the bill and then take that extra bit. Ew. So I was like nipping a fiver here and there, like over. And I'd like done a whole shift where I'd been doing it, and I thought, I've got 50 quid to go out with here. I'm so thrilled. And my manager caught she saw all the receipts in the bin with my handwriting. She was like, is the till down? What's going on? There's like 20 tickets here with you, like, with writing the coffee sign. And because I'm like you, I'm a cat. I went, I'm really sorry. I just needed the money and going out the weekend. So, JD Sports, how do we get to comedy?
So, I dropped out of BTEC drama and I was like, I felt quite bad. But then I had an urge that I kind of wanted to do comedy. Now, in my head, I thought to myself, I can't do comedy until I'm 18. I just had it in my head that you need to be 18 to be in pubs and bars and whatever. And then I went back and did A-levels the following year, which was garbage. I don't know why people even bother doing that shit. Waste of time. Sociology, psychology, fuck off. Absolute garbage. I mean, if you really want to do that, then it's great. Education
if
is the key.
If anyone here is studying psychology, don't worry. Keep going.
But I should have stayed in the drama. It made no sense for me to do it.
But when you were at school, when you were at JD Sports, wherever, were people saying to you, you're really fucking funny?
Yeah, but it was before I knew I wanted to do sort of comedy. So it was, I was quite open back then and quite a strong personality. So I always just thought, yeah, well, I'm funny, but, you know, it's like, we all know people funnier than us who don't do comedy at all. Like,
yeah, right.
My friends are hilarious people, so I just never really took it as that. And then, in college, as much as I hated college, there was a flyer on a table that said there was like a night where there's singers, dancers, and
open mic night,
and it said comedy, and I went, And at the time, I was sort of watching lots of like Dave Chappelle and like Def Jam, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, oh, I should give this a go. And I gave it a go around just a few months after my 18th birthday. And then
did you put anything together or you just get up and just...
No,
sort of...
I had some... Yeah, I thought of some lines and stuff. But you know, when you're really, really new at comedy and very inexperienced And most comedians you speak to will say this when they first started. They didn't know that you can keep the same material.
Yeah, right.
So every, just changing it all the time.
Every time I'd go on stage, I would change my material. So that went well as it could go. But I remember that the following year, if I'm correct, was... So I always date how long I've been doing comedy for in like a really old man kind of way. By I remember doing comedy before the smoking ban. So, and if I'm correct, I think the smoking ban was
2007.
2007.
Yeah, I used to be a smoker. me and Hannah used to be full-on smokers, and we gave up after the ban. You stuck to it. I did. So I do remember 2007.
And that actually worked for someone.
Yeah, it actually did work for you.
Oh, that was great.
Because you had to go outside all of a sudden. It suddenly didn't seem fun anymore. And we made a pact, but I broke it.
I'm telling you, smoking again. But as a comedian, it was like night and day being on stage. You don't know now, but back then. I remember doing a gig pre-smoking ban to smoking ban and it being 10 times better. Everything was different. You could see people. People were more focused. My lungs was great.
It didn't stink of fags.
And then from then, so when I started comedy, it was up and down. I went through countless jobs because the problem is, family couldn't support me.
No.
So I had to get a job and try and do comedy. Problem was that my comedy dreams were so much bigger than my whatever job I was doing.
Yeah,
so
right.
They would always say things like, well, you know, we need you here Saturday. And I'd go, yeah, I can't because I've got to go to Manchester to do this gig, but I'll make up for it. And then they would just get rid of me. And then I got into security. My first official security shift was for the royal wedding, Prince William.
What, and you'd never done security before?
No, is that, I mean,
here for the royals, know what I'm doing. You're all right with me, babe.
Hi, guys. I'm wearing my new suit. First day. Anyway, here's the ring. Because it was a royal wedding, there was so many security. I mean, I was literally outside a tube station
telling people
to take the left.
Yeah.
Fine. You weren't at the end of the aisle.
Yeah, no. My job...
I think we call it a steward now, do we?
My job was so useless, they could have done it with a sign or strong winds. Like. Yeah. There's no need for me. And then, so from then, security, what I loved about security, and I understand, I will understand all of the arguments against zero-hour contracts. I get that completely, especially in terms of healthcare and all that sort of stuff. As a comedian, we don't understand what that is. Back when I was doing security, a zero-hour contract was the fucking lifesaver for me because it meant I could do as many shifts as I needed to, take off whenever I wanted to, and I could continue doing comedy, and that's the only... I stuck with that job. I wish I'd started security at, like, 18, because it would have helped me so much more. And then I decided... So I was gonna kill myself in 2014, so I nearly killed myself. I say nearly. I got everything. I didn't actually go through it, but I was ready to kill myself. It's another story. And then that was in April 2014, and then I just decided I have to make a change. I have to move to London to try and make comedy work out, because it's killing me... doing comedy for about 8 years and it just not working out for me and working all these jobs. And then I moved to London in September 2014. I moved on my 26th birthday. And then a year later, I got signed to an agent in 2015, the same agent I'm with now. And it's been a fucking roller coaster since then, baby.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah, I mean...
It's a long journey of comedians, isn't it? Because so many people go, oh my God, overnight success. They do it a lot with actors or whatever. But particularly it happens with comedians. Like, you know, I know a lot of comedians. And it is for sure about at least 10 years before you even get some sort of goodness out of it. It's like a good 10 years. And suddenly we might start seeing you on telly. We might start seeing you on the panel shows. It's a long journey, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what's different now is, and there's a lot more who are a lot shorter than that, a lot more who are like 4 or 5.
I thought you meant like short.
Is social media as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's changed everything. How do you feel about that?
Well, here's the thing. I'm old school. I remember when I was doing comedy, I was like, what's this MySpace?
How do you know you're funny?
I had a MySpace comedy page, guys.
That's amazing.
Yeah, me and Tom.
I had a MySpace page. You had a MySpace page. Are we just old? Yeah. Yes.
You're old bastards.
No.
I didn't quite understand it, but I had one.
Yeah, and so nowadays, the thing is, and I understand this with the sort of new school, comedy is much broader now than it's ever been. You know, you think comedian, you go stand-up. Yeah. Or like a comedy actor or comedy writer or someone who can come on a panel show and be funny. Whereas Comedy now is like someone who can do TikTok videos, someone who does straight to camera stuff.
But how do you know you're going to be funny? So some of these people that are on TikTok, and granted,
some of these people who are on TikTok.
Did I sound posh when I say that?
No, just TikTok. Old.
Yeah, really, really old. But how do you know you're funny? Like, what if they get some big ass gig that suddenly they're going to be live? How do they know their material is funny? People are liking, it's really easy just to like half like something and half laugh at something and go, that's funny. But are you going to really find me funny for an hour in a room?
It happens a lot. So what the trend is now with a lot of, I'd say more comedy agents is, and I understand why they do this. If you are someone who's got a following on TikTok, could be for anything, or Instagram, could be for anything. Literally, you know, how many stupid accounts do you follow where somebody just does the same prank every time?
Yeah, right. Someone's got like 350 million, whatever, and they're literally just titting about.
Well,
and I had to beg to get a blue tick.
Yeah.
And I'm on telly. Like, I was doing loads of telly, and they're like, who the fuck are you? And I was like, I didn't actually want a blue tick. It was my manager.
Like,
we need to get you a blue tick. But they made me
want
to get a blue tick because they kept going on about the fact I didn't have a fucking blue tick. Anyway.
So what happens is now is they see that. They see that this person has, like, you know, 300,000 followers or whatever. A lot of comedy agencies now will go to that person and they will say, why don't you join us? You know, they've got, like, some really good stand-ups on there or whatever. And they say, hey, you've already got what, you know, even people like me want more of a need. You've got a massive following. Why don't you just come and do 5 minutes, open mics, learn, look, just get good, get used to it.
Yeah.
Then put on a tour. We can help you get some writers in, and then they will be making like six figures quite quickly because they've already got people who are willing to come and see. It's very different to say somebody like a Mo Gilligan who was already a stand-up comedian, got a social media platform,
and then it just elevated him. Yeah, that's
but
all.
What they're doing now is they're going social media platform, and then they're saying let's just get you in. And I've seen some of them on stage, and they are terrible.
Because
but they're terrible because they're new.
Yeah, and they haven't done the 10 years.
I also don't think they even really want to do it. The problem is that if you're really popular on social media, and
that's quite a nice place to stay in a way, I suppose.
It's a nice place to stay.
Stay in your house.
There's lots of money to make, really, because if you just do this one thing, how are you really going to monetize that? The best way to do it is a live tour or something. So I understand that, and I've seen.
I actually feel a bit sorry for him. Do you know what I mean? Because they're being getting out on a big stage, and they're going, "Fucking hell, I'm not ready for this."
But also, a lot of their audience are first-time comedy fans, so they don't really know what to expect. Which is great for comedy because you're bringing people out who are new. So technically, what their newbie beginner stand-up type attitude works better with them than it would on more of a seasoned audience. But I can't get mad at it. I get it. It makes sense.
I know.
It's a genius move.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Let me ask you a question, because you were saying about coming to London at 18.
Yeah.
And also, I'm just
26, sorry.
Oh, you were 26 when you came to London. Yeah. I was thinking about you saying that, like, back in your school, you'd never really noticed, like, how rich or not you were, because everyone was in a sort of similar boat and it was just a bit of difference in shoes or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you arrived in London, were you suddenly aware of yourself in a different way? Like, having come from a community that was all sort of like in a similar level, and suddenly you're in a big city and...
Completely. What I like about London is that, you know, northeast, southwest or whatever, it's completely different.
Yeah,
there's just complete different divides. I mean, you're one tube station away from just like, oh my God, what? This place needs help to, you know, affluent million-dollar areas in London. And
I've got a friend who lives in North London. I think she's in tonight, and she never comes to South London. She's like, South, where's that?
Oh my God.
She lives in North London.
If I have to speak...
Are you there, Ellie? I can see you.
What part of North London? Archway, okay, yeah. So North London's interesting because, like, Archway, and then you've got, like, Islington, all those sort of places are quite nice. But then once you go down, you've got, like, the spiciest station in London for me, is Finsbury Park. Finsbury Park is Spiceville, man.
And it goes off into the overground on the Orange Line, and it's, I don't know where I'm at with Finsbury Park.
It's one of those stations where I walk out and I go, what have I walked into? What's happening here? Why, who's fighting now? What's arguing? Ah! What's going on? Yeah, for me, it's like the spiciest. But that's funny because you're, like, a couple of stations away and it just
like Million Dollarville, yeah.
Million Dollarville, yeah. Yeah. But when I moved to London, I moved into a house share, and I was in that same house share for like 6 years.
How did you, by me asking, how did you like afford, like London's like, it's really pricey, always has been, even especially if you're coming from, I don't know, was it expensive in Birmingham?
No. Where were you? Black Country, but right
Black
near.
Black Country,
but where I was quite lucky was that even though my mum did not support my comedy dreams.
how dare she?
at all. My mum, and this is probably just a mum thing, she never charged me rent.
Because
and that was a massive thing for me. So my house, my mum's house is a council house. Pretty sure she pays 350 quid for it, like a mum. She never charged me any of that. She works all the time. And I think she knew that it would have been harder to charge me because she knew how irregular my work was with the comedy.
So maybe she did support you then. She supported me in that sense.
Yes, completely. Yeah. My mum. Yeah. I always say that about my mum. I said she never believed in my comedy dreams, but she supported me enough where I didn't have to pay rent and I could run off. Because I know that if I had to pay however much rent she wanted, I'd have to work more and probably do gigs less. So in doing that, I moved to London into a house share, and it was 450 quid a month. And that 450 quid was everything, included sort of water, electric and all that sort of stuff. So... and I was quite lucky that the company that I've been working with, the one that I did the royal wedding with, the same company, they have loads of places in London. So I used to work at I lived in Wembley. So I used to work at Wembley Arena all the time. That was like a regular gig for me. I'd work there all the time. So I was making just enough. And then once I got the agent in 2015, that made all the difference because it was literally, I would get a gig or a radio thing or TV thing that would pay £200. Oh my God, make it rain, baby! Oh my God, where's the K's catalogue now?
So, I had it.
So in 2017, and you'd gone to Edinburgh, were you with your agent then?
Yes, so.
Because how did you afford Edinburgh? Because it's fucking mental anyway.
I'm really glad you asked that. So the thing with Edinburgh is there's always a big talk about the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm sure you know it's the biggest arts festival in the world. It's like the longest as well, isn't it? It's like a month or whatever.
Oh, it's long, especially if you're up there gigging.
Oh, it's long.
Oh, she's long.
It's long. So a lot. So there is always a big debate about Edinburgh in terms of the prices of. Accommodation is mental. You will stay in Edinburgh.
Isn't there a big thing going on at the moment about the festival coming up this year and how they've the prices have like tripled, quadrupled? It's really bad. It's always been bad though.
It's really bad this year.
Like it's like again.
You're looking at paying between about 1,200 to 1,600 for this one place in Edinburgh, Scotland, for a month. But that's not. That's not even the craziest money. So how the way I afforded Edinburgh is certain agencies do this where they will cover your upfronts.
Mm.
So just a few of the price things you have to pay for Edinburgh. One is photography. You need a photographer to take your photos. They need the editing. You need to get a graphic designer to do all your...
Get your posters printed up.
Get your graphic designers in. Then you need to pay for your venue. You need to pay something up front, which is about $1,000 for your venue. Little bits of cost.
And all of that, you have to pay to be in the brochure.
Then you've got to pay to be in the website as well.
Pay some flyers if you can afford it, or you flyer yourself.
That is a big money that catches people off guard. I was paying for my flyers £450 a week for a month. I had to pay 450 because you need the right amount of flyers to get them in. So what my agency does, and some other agencies, is they will cover, if I'm correct, the first sort of $3,000, which means it's just enough so you can get to Edinburgh and you've got everything else paid for, which is great. Now, what my agency do, and there are comics who have a go at this, which I think it just depends on your agency. If your agency is acting like a bloody mafia boss about it, my agency, it was never even mentioned. They covered it because they knew that the work's going to come through. Don't worry, we'll cover. It's all going to be covered. Even if your Edinburgh doesn't go well, it's fine. The right people have seen you. We'll get you more TV work. We'll get gigs. It was not an issue. And I really appreciate it. I would not have been able to do Edinburgh 2017 if they did not cover that first $3,000. But there are other agencies that don't. I mean...
But also, it's not even just that. It's like, obviously, you've got to pay your rent and everything. And then it's not working for a month, is it? You are not working for a month when you're there. You're not earning money for a month. Well, I mean, when we went up, we certainly weren't. So the knock-on effect...
That's an awkward thing.
The knock-on effect of that. I mean, when I went up to Edinburgh, my comedy partner, she's in tonight. Hello, love. Hello, Bush. Here she is. We didn't have anyone that we spent... I think the first one was like nearly $9,000, but there was two of us.
Yep.
But we only got up there because there was two of us, and I think we got some... free accommodation from someone or something like that, like in some student uni thing, accommodation. But it was like beyond that, like we could only really sustain about 3 Edinburghs because we were so skint. Yeah. And that has been a huge knock on effect in my life in trying to buy property, pay it back, so much debt.
But it's not only that, is it? We talked about this quite a lot. And I think you sort of like touched on it earlier. It's not just the cost of getting up there, because I think in doing this podcast and all the guests we've had, there were a couple of things that, regardless of what our guests have done or what their story's been, that they have in common. And one is money.
Yeah.
Getting paid in this industry, in whatever way you are in it, not getting paid, how long it takes to get paid, and how much you're supposed to pay for in advance. But not just the things you've mentioned, like the actual cost, accommodation, whatever, but also the space to make the work.
Yeah.
Like, you get up to Edinburgh, and we spoke about this a lot, like with Vix, and how some people have taken 6 months off to write their Edinburgh show. You and Vix had been writing it late at night after you'd finished your shift front of house.
Yeah,
like, because
it
just wasn't...
Poor jobs.
So it's not just the cost of... You know, it's the space that having money gives you to make work as well.
It's a whole thing. That's basically how it is. You've almost got to play the game if you can. But in terms of the money, so you normally get your settlements back like November-ish from Edinburgh in August. I've been nominated twice, done really well. Never made money at Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I've never directly met. I've never looked at my settlement and been like, boom, always in the red. Last time, 2019... I think I was in the red by £200.
Oh,
and
that's
really good
done,
going.
Yeah.
That's
and
amazing.
I jumped. I was like, "Oh my gosh, yes!" And I've made way more money from doing Edinburgh in terms of the shows that I've had, like Don't Hate the Players, Mock the Week, all that sort of stuff, all from Edinburgh because people have come to Edinburgh.
Yeah, of course.
So there's a lot of people who are there's a lot of producers, directors, all that, comedy heads who are lazy. So what they do is they go to Edinburgh and get it all in.
Yeah, because 2 weeks.
Trying to message them and say, can you come to my gig? And they will not come. But at Edinburgh, they will all come in. And the thing with Edinburgh is the TV festival is like the 22nd, 23rd, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
Like that. So then everybody's up there. And then you get everybody at your gig.
Do you think that's a good thing, though? I feel like that needs to change because, you know, there's so many incredible people that can't afford to get up there. And is that your only fucking opportunity? Is that your only opportunity to get spotted? It just seems unfair, you know?
Speaking of Brit Stars, you do Edinburgh, right? And obviously, you know...
Get nominated.
You get nominated twice. And it's not like a huge financial...
Yeah.
benefit, but it has huge benefits. Obviously, you start like getting TV offers, and what's that like suddenly going into that world? How did you feel going into that world? Suddenly, like, so your mum suddenly knows that you like you're a comedian because her neighbours have seen you on the telly, so she might have to like suddenly believe it. But like, what was that like? How did that change? How did you feel suddenly like people recognise you? They know who you are. What's life like that?
I didn't leave security until I really had to, which is what everybody sort of does. I'll tell you my...
Did you worry about that? Like, because I know I have, leaving my actual sort of the other job, going, fuck, am I going to do it? Am I going to do it?
Yeah.
Because it's frightening, isn't it?
Well, I was like, I need one big paycheck and then I can take that leap of faith. And that big paycheck came from when I first did Live at the Apollo. So when I first did a spot at Live at the Apollo, I used to work there.
That's so amazing.
I love that.
That's so amazing.
So when I walked in, I know, crazy, right? It's the same pin code. And because I'd not been doing my shifts because things had been really picking up. And,
I was a bit of a
coward in terms of like, I'm not coming back. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go and leave them there. When I came home, I swear to God, when I came home from doing my Live at the Apollo, my P45 was there from my old boss. It was just there. And I was like, oh, okay, wow. I'm like, this is it.
This is it. So it's happening.
Decision was made for you in a way.
Yeah, it was there. And I remember it took about 3 months for the money to come into the bank. And I was holding on.
Oh, God.
And then I'll never forget when it came in, I was like, that's it. That's it. I've done it. I think I can now focus on just trying to be the best comedian I can be.
And how did that change the game for you, being able to go, right, I can just write today and just do that?
Well, so what I was doing was I worked for that one company that was doing all the different venues, you know, the Roundhouse, O2s, all that. And then my main job was a night job. I used to work nights at the University of Westminster, and I used to do it 10 till 6. So what I used to do was I used to do comedy, try and do an earlier gig if I can get on first, get changed in the Burger King down by Leicester Square, like Superman, and then I would run and then start my shift at 10. And then it was literally behind my house. It just worked out that this uni was right behind where I used to live. So then after that, I was just like, oh my gosh, wow, this is crazy. And then I just took a bit of time sort of
slept,
and I was working on my second show. So that helped take up a lot of the time as well. But just going back to what you said about the writing shows and working and stuff, the problem with Edinburgh is, for a lot of comics, is between, let alone just your general mental health, January, February, you're normally like, oh, should I do a show? Do I want to do a show? I've got an idea for a show. March, you're like, I'm doing a show. Then near the end of March, you get your photos done for your show. And then April, May, June, July are horrendous because it's you doing 45 minutes to an hour at various places all over the place. And the problem with that is, for a lot of us, is it's summer. So audiences generally do not want to be in the room. You're doing a lot longer than normal.
Yeah, not for an hour.
For an hour, trying to work on your material. I always tell people, I say, the build-up to doing Edinburgh is horrendous. Once you get to Edinburgh and you start your show, it'll be fine, because they're all in the mood to be there. But when you're doing it over the summer, it's horrible. And you're getting less money because there's probably going to be less audience members and you're doing new material for an hour. So promoters generally don't pay you as much. And with comedy, the money has not changed in 30 years. It's the exact same money.
Well, like gigging and stuff.
Gigging
like,
money.
Because
somebody put up a post last week and it had people on there like Harry Hill, but it said Harry Hall, which was his old name back in like the 90s. And it had a list. It had this woman's gig list of all these old comics. And we're looking at the fees and we're like, it's the exact same.
Wow,
as it was
buggers.
In like 1992. It doesn't go up at all.
That's mad.
What does your mum think now about your comedy? Like, and your life in general? Like, what does she...
buying a house. Yay! I'm buying a house.
Yay!
Like, yeah. I tell you though, it's taken a lot longer than it should, because...
Hey, listen, you've done all right. That's good.
She's too proud, though.
You're 33. Though. Like, that's amazing.
I'm like, Mum, where's the paperwork? Amazing. Can you fill the paperwork? Don't worry, I was getting paperwork. She's taking it. I think she's a bit too prideful. But yeah, I'm definitely sort of buying her house. I mean, my mum, you know, she's been on the council now for like 30 odd years. And my auntie, same thing, 30 odd years.
Yeah.
And then once you're on there that long, you can actually buy the house. But I just said, Mum, let me just, like, she's in her mid-50s. And I'm like, Mum, let me just buy a house and then it's yours. Yeah. Like, you just do. I'm never going to live there. I don't want to live at that house again.
That's amazing.
So it's just there for you. And that's, she's really proud. She's really sort of happy about it. I think for her, because you got to understand from my family's point of view how weird it is that April 2014, they found out I was ready to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And I nearly killed myself. And then March 2015, they see me. No, March 2016, I think. No, 2015 or 2016, they see me on Russell Howard's show doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And for them, it's just like, wow. Because I was getting a lot of phone calls, like a message when I first moved because they were still
so worried.
They were still worried. And then, yeah, it's just slowly been just getting better, I guess. But yeah, it's you know, it's been really fun. And I always try and help out. Acts, because I know a lot of I've given acts some fees before at gigs, because acts, you can always tell somebody who's like they're kind of struggling. Like I was talking to one act and she was just saying, oh, I got paid, da-da-da-da. And I was like, oh, great, man. She's like, yeah, so I'm gonna use this 20 for food and then this 20 is gonna be, and I said you can just have my fee, it's fine. And I gave her the fee because I'm just like, I know what it's like. I know the difference, say, like it was £200. I said, I know the difference between like how much £200 is going to change things for you for that week.
Yeah.
Rather than,
yeah, when you've got no money. I've been in that position. I was lent money from other people.
We talk about this all the time about, you know, if you've never been without money, like truly, truly, like, you know, my stepdaddy lost everything and we ended up in a council flat. There was a moment where, because we had a lot in the 80s, he was a bodyguard.
Yeah.
And had a security company and all that and lost everything. We lost our home and everything. I think when you've been there and you've gone to those depths and you've had nothing, you've seen your parents struggle and really fucking hard, you don't ever forget that. But I think if you've never experienced being without, it's really hard to get people to understand that aren't from that. Yeah. World, like when someone says I'm skint, is it you're that skint that you can't get on the bus, or are you that skint that you've dipped into your savings? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
it's not
how it is
lot.
It's just privilege, and I'm not class bashing, it's just you saying that is like it's lovely to give back, isn't it? And to go, I fucking remember what it was and I won't ever forget that. And that's like when we were talking in the dressing room about going, yeah, I mean, I'm not really working class anymore, I live a middle class life, I now own my own property. And I'm coming at this from a privileged place, but I'm so connected to my working class roots. I'll never forget that. Do you still feel really connected?
Yeah.
I think you do. Or the answer is yes.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No, definitely. Yeah, I feel very connected. What you've said there is just like, you're very honest. Like you've said, you know, I'm very connected to my working class roots, but I can't class myself as working class
that
way.
Can't. No, of course.
But I feel like, especially in comedy, there's so many comedians who are just liars. It's like... It's like you're selling out arenas and you're like, oh, yeah, I have a pee bucket in my bedroom. I'm just like, oh, I was on a bus here, but you're not on a bus. Stop lying. You're not on a bus.
You do not fly economy.
Stop talking about it like you do. Just do past tense. Oh,
when I was on the bus.
When I used to get on the bus. Tell you who
I absolutely love, like as a comic for their own, Mickey Flanagan.
Yeah, right? He's really awesome.
Oh, so brilliant.
The reason why Mickey Flanagan is like the king of the working class comedians of everyone.
He acknowledges his privilege.
He acknowledges it. He opened his show, right? Mickey Flanagan, similar sort of thing to me. Both our dads was in prison, blah, blah, blah. Mickey Flanagan used to sell fish, trying to sell fish on the markets in East London. You know, yeah, it wasn't easy for him. Mickey Flanagan opened one of his shows and just like, he's in an arena, you know, and he's like, oh no, working class boy done good, all that sort of stuff. And he's just like, oh, I tell you, I don't know what to do with myself. I got myself a leaf blower.
I got
a leaf blower and he's like, I was just using my leaf blower to blow away all the money. Just like the honesty.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it's almost like this idea to faint poverty as comedians, because to try and connect. Because the thing is, when a lot of comedians are coming up, and even actors as well, I would say even actors are coming up, their fan base might be very working class, or they support them because they look, it's a working class.
Yeah, like me,
boy
yeah.
done good, yeah. girl done good, one of us. Da-da. As they have got increasingly more successful, they then think that they still need to keep doing that to maintain their audience. And it's like, you don't have to do that. They like you as a person, probably for your honesty and whatever. The fact you've got jokes is just an extra. My agent always says, people don't go to see comedians because they want to hear their jokes. They go to see comedians because they like them as people.
It's
the same thing as people who have come in for the podcast because they like you too. That's why they come here.
Or we bullied them into it. There's a bit of that, yeah. I'm so nervous about running out of time. I've got such an important question for you.
I'm such a ranter and I apologize.
No, I've got such an important question.
Okay, go on.
Well, I think it's the same question.
Mine's a bit heavy.
Oh, no, okay. Well, it's more important than your question.
Okay, go on.
You were saying before the show that the next thing that you're doing is called Britain's Greatest Takeaway.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't let you. What, Greatest Takeaway?
Britain's Top Takeaway. It's coming soon in May.
BBC Two.
Yeah.
I wouldn't let you tell me anything about it because I'm like, this literally sounds like my ideal fucking job. Do you go around the country getting paid to have takeaways?
Okay.
Can I come with you?
I would say it's even better than that. Like, they're all coming to us.
What?
So we don't travel. So, okay, it's called Britain's Top Takeaways. It starts Monday, 9th of May on BBC Two. It's hosted by Sarah Cox, and then there's me, who is like sort of sidekick jokey. The way I would describe it is it's imagine Bake Off mixed with Gogglebox.
Love it. Sold. Sold. Thank you.
So there's a load of like little pods, and loads of different pods, and each pod will have sort of a takeaway in there. You know, a bunch of guys, takeaways. Each episode is a different delicacy. So there's southern fried chicken, there's burger, there's Indian.
And do you know what you're getting each week?
Well, how it works is they will all put their menus. I then, via video chat, talk to five families. So there's the same five families every week. So you get to know the families.
Oh, amazing.
They then get to order. They get to look at and go, "Oh, what do you think of the southern fried chicken?" And, "Oh yeah, I think it's very good." And then I get to talk to the chefs with them and go, Linda and Keith want to know about your chips. Why are they called whatever, you know, masala chips or whatever? And then they get to order all the food, right? The three-course menu. Then we get to see it get delivered to them. They get reviewed eating the food like Gogglebox.
I want to be Linda and Keith.
And literally, why the fuck are we not on this program? This is the best.
Then I phone them again afterwards, each one of the five families, get their scores. So everybody gets scores. And then we decide who has the top takeaway in, you know, that food. So one of them's noodles, and then we get to find out who is the winner of the best noodles here. It was a great show.
Right, well, I think we're going to do like a quick poll, because we were sat backstage before and we were asking you, well, we were sort of going, Laura was saying, oh, what do you think's like most popular takeaway? And you said, don't say now, but you said you know what the answer to that question.
Yeah, Darren
question.
Was on the wheel and there was a question which you got right.
I did.
It was the final question, wasn't it? For the wheel.
Don't necessarily I won't give away the whole thing.
So you know for a fact.
That's not out for a year.
Just asking just quickly, show of hands for Chinese. Who prefers a Chinese? Oh, only two.
Well, who thinks Chinese is the number one takeaway in this country?
Anyone?
No.
Just one person at the back. Oh, and two. Oh, three of you. So three of you think, okay, what about Indian? Oh, big show of hands. Okay.
Wow.
Okay, what else have we got?
Pizza, I reckon.
Italian pizza.
What about like
Thai? You know you're not getting one. This table's so enthusiastic. Pizza! Like, you know, there's none here.
So go on then, tell us.
Yeah, so a study for January 2021 said that the most popular takeaway in this country now is Chinese.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those three people were right. Well done.
Overtook Indian. Yeah, Chinese is now the number one.
So the Indian used to be the I've got a quick question actually.
Is this your deep question?
It's kind of deep.
You can be as deep as you like.
It's just actually more like I'm just more intrigued. So I've just noticed it. A couple of working class comedians that we've interviewed.
Who have you interviewed?
We just did Tom Mayhew.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I actually very recently and. I was looking at your reviews and his reviews, not comparing or anything, but...
he was better.
And his was so much better. He had 5 stars. No. And both your reviews and his reviews, it said, funny, hilarious, articulate. And it kind of fucking irked me.
Yeah.
Because I just thought, would you say that about a middle-class comedian?
Yeah.
Or someone that didn't have a working-class accent or something? Yeah. Does it bother you? It's just a question that sort of irked me a bit.
That's a very good question. I've never been asked that before. I don't think I'm articulate. I'm not very good with words. They probably just look at me. Because you got to understand these reviews.
Everyone's gasping, you're wrong.
I don't think I'm very articulate.
Do
you think that's a working class thing though? Like a kind of no, I'm not.
That's not the right words.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe
education thing.
Yeah,
like,
maybe, you know, in my head, when I think of articulate, I think of people who like read books often or go to university and all that sort of stuff. I don't really do any of that sort of stuff at all. I mean, I read books like Marvel, but I'm not. So I don't see myself as articulate in that way. It might be because a lot of the reviewers are sort of very partial. I mean, if you can make a living being a reviewer,
people need to stop doing that.
It does happen a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sort of irked me. We spoke about it the other day.
It's obviously meant as a compliment, isn't it? But it's such a backhanded compliment, and I think it often comes from a place of low expectation. You know some words. Very well done.
You know what? Now that you've said that, it has kind of pissed me off.
You better let your agent know, babe, because it's on their website.
That will get changed now. Yeah. I'm not going to use that. Now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, it's because it's basically, it'll be a very sort of posh. You got to think, it's somebody who writes reviews for a living.
Yeah.
You're not coming from a sort of working class background. It's a posh person. They're looking at me as a young sort of black kid with a, you know, sort of West Midlands accent. And they go, oh, he doesn't sound the way I expected him to sound.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Change your fucking tune, I say. Sorry. Not you.
All right. It's a strange way to wrap up, but okay.
Do you know what? I could keep going all night, but we can't. We always finish the show asking our guest who they would like to celebrate this week, a working class hero of theirs. Who would that be for you tonight, Dave?
I'm going to be the annoying person, and it's going to sound cheesy, but I just want to use this to say that I'm forgetting my words here. You see, articulate, huh?
Yeah. Scrub it. Take it back.
Can I say comedians in working class comedians?
Of course you can.
Just because it's so hard to start making money to live off if you're not, because not everyone's good at, say, social media, admin. Some people aren't good at, you know, booking gigs. And I just think it's so hard to do. It's so hard to work a job, a full-time job, and then do this other hobby that you want to be a job at night.
Yeah.
And then wake up in the morning and you're traveling and you're not getting paid. And a lot of the time, there are promoters who will say things like, hey, man, I'll be there. I'll be there to see your set. If you do well, I'll book you. You go there, they're not there. Mm-hmm. And then you message them and they go, oh, I couldn't make it. Sorry, how did it go? And you're like, oh, I did well. Okay. And you don't hear from them again. And I think that, and there are definite heroes in that, in terms of, you know, people who would drive me as a teenage boy and everything. Oh, don't worry, we'll do a gig together. But because he's open spot, I'm not going to charge you petrol.
Yeah.
I'm getting paid. Don't worry about it. There was a lot of those people who were so nice to me and they really helped me. Actually, you know what? Let me say those are the heroes. The other comedians who would do little things that would make a difference. Like, for example, they would pick me up from a house and they would drop me up from a house. Whereas sometimes, you know, and I didn't mind, they would say, you know, can you meet me here? Get yourself to my house. And sometimes they would live a good few miles away and I'd get there. But the ones who would pick me up from my house, it was just little things like that would make such a difference for me and would help me. And if they didn't charge me petrol, and I would always offer, you know, I didn't want any freebies necessarily. But I would say, I'm going back now. I would say just any working class comedian, because it's not easy, and there still isn't any sort of, especially with Edinburgh, any sort of proper support for you at all. Or my nan.
Yeah, you've got to get your nan in at the end.
Can you just... quickly tell us a little bit about your nan, just a little bit.
Oh, my nan's great. She's really fun. Yeah, she came here in the 60s. She had seven kids. She had to leave one in Jamaica before she came as a youngster. And he's only recently, he's now back in the country. So he's now like, so she left, she had to leave him when he was one to get a better life here. She had six kids here, my uncles and aunties. I've never met this guy until a month ago.
Wow.
And I'm like, and he's now 61. And it's really nice because my nan, she was a carer for 45 years. And she's, you know, it sounds bad on me, but my nan taught me a lot about caring and being up. My nan's saying, and I'll never forget this, is if the door can shut, they can stay. That's my nan's thing.
Oh my God, I love that.
And she would always say that, and my nan's house was always a place where we would all go. If I fell out with my mum, I'll go to my nan's house. Always invited up there. Everybody was there, and it's always just been a central place. So yeah. You know what? Screw the comics. My nan.
Yeah.
and what's your nan's name?
My nan's name. So because she's Jamaican, there's 17 names. So we always call her Joan.
Yeah.
But it's not her name.
That's not her name. That's not her name. No, her name is so much better. Her name's Daphne.
Oh, yes. Wow.
Yes.
Oh. Well, we're celebrating Daphne, Joan, as well as you today, Darren. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. Guys, give it up for Darren Harriet. Thank you, mate. Thank you. Just to let you know, folks, the Proper Class podcast is now going weekly and continues next Thursday, where we have the one and only Vicky McClaw joining us. Say what? Yes, so be sure to tune in. It's a real corker, that one. And whilst I've got you here, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at The Proper Class Podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy. The Proper Class Podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangaby Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music. This live podcast was recorded as part of the Hoxton Hall class season, which is running until the 28th of May. So get down there, folks, and be part of the conversation. It even includes their very own live soap opera called Hoxton Street, which apparently is brilliant. So get booking, folks. Hoxton Hall are a charity and they're heavily reliant on donations. So in order to continue their brilliant work in providing opportunities for emerging artists and to maintain their youth arts educational programmes, they do need help. They need donations. So if you can give anything, folks, please pop on their website and give what you can on hoxtonhall.co.uk.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.